Hey guys, welcome to Entrepreneurs Uncut. Today we have Dan Williams on the show, and he's an entrepreneur and certified EOS implementer. Dan came from humble upbringings to becoming a part owner and CEO of a large-scale, successful Australian IT company. Throughout the episode, Dan draws on his experience being a part of high-performing teams, whether it be in sport or business, and reflects on his own leadership journey, now helping other entrepreneurs and leadership teams realise their potential in business, as well as creating exciting new ventures of his own. Dan is genuine, thoughtful, and cares deeply about his work. It really resonates throughout the whole episode. I hope you enjoy it, so let's get to the show. Dan Williams, welcome to Entrepreneurs Uncut.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Yeah, good for you to be on the show, mate. Dan, with all our guests, I always like to wind back the clock and take you back in time to when you were young and maybe give us a bit of a sense of what it was like growing up in the Williams household.
Well, I had a great childhood, lots of fond memories. I was a bit of a rat bag. I still am, in case you haven't noticed. In a northwest of Melbourne, a suburb called Pasco Vale, affectionately known as Paco. It's the Australian way. You got to give everything a nickname. I never really took stock of my childhood until sort of having kids of my own. I had a really privileged upbringing, in the sense that we never went without anything that we needed. Yeah. And always, had love and affection, and a big family. So my grandmother was one of 13 kids. So wow. It meant that I had lots of second cousins.
Yeah.
And my mum sort of was plotted across a long sort of timeline of, cousins. So she was the same age as some of her second cousins and uncles and aunties and stuff. And so we always had lots of family around. And, from that sort of perspective, I think that has given me strong family values, but grew up in a really multicultural neighborhood. I think it went through waves when I reflect on it. When I was sort of primary school age, 5 to 12, I'd have friends that were, from Lebanon, friends that were from Greece, like first generation Australians, Italy, you name it. And I love that because it exposed me to all sorts of religions, sets of beliefs and all that sort of stuff as well. And, I'd ride my bike to school every day and collect kids on the way to school. And, some of my fondest memories were actually tearing up the streets on I had one of those dragster bikes with the long seat. I love that. And I've got an older sister. She's 18 months older than me, so we're very close in age. And it meant that we had big friendship groups because our friends are all similar age. We're only 1 year apart in school.
Yep.
So, there's lots of fond memories. And always I was one of those kids that was out of the house as soon as the sun came up and I was back just as it was coming down.
Right. And your parents always gave you that freedom?
Yeah, they did. And I reflect on it now. I am trying to do the same with my son. But, I had a lot of freedom as a kid. And I'm very close with my mum. And I was talking to her recently about how far I used to ride on my bike.
Yeah.
So I was 10 Ks northwest of the CBD. And I'd easily ride my bike in there and back as a, like a primary school age kid.
Into the CBD.
Yeah. I'm a little dragster. we had a really tight family unit. Both my parents, John and Leanne, both worked two jobs. So I think that's what gave me a lot of freedom as well.
two jobs each.
Yeah. Right. So, and I think my sister, I would describe it as she kept the home fires burning. she was the student, goody two shoes, you know, and she was the one who set the unattainable example. And I was off with my mates, you know, tearing up the streets, and I knew everyone, and I'd, you know, be riding around. And it's funny, I've always been a big eater. And I think I attribute it to the fact that a lot of the cultures that I socialize with were very food oriented.
Right.
Europeans
and
Middle Eastern as well. Yeah. And so I'd probably on the way home from school have two dinners, get home, eat my dinner, finish my sister's, and then have dessert. Yeah. So lots of fond memories. And I've got I don't have a huge sort of group of friends these days as an adult, but some of my closest friends are the ones from when I was just a little kid, in my neighborhood. Yeah.
Wow. And talking about your parents, I mean, that sounds like they had a really strong work ethic. Was that unusual at the time that your parents had worked so much? And maybe was there your other friends with their parents that didn't have to work? When, what was your perspective on that when you were young?
Yeah. So I don't recall anyone else having the same sort of circumstances. I think my old man was a diesel mechanic, and he sort of worked his way up through the ranks as you do, like a foreman, you know, in the workshop, and kind of like a manager, leader, and really in a sort of real blue collar sort of environment. And my mum used to work at the school as a what's called an integration aide, so helping kids in the classroom who need it with a physical, intellectual disabilities. And both of them were probably not the highest paying jobs. And so we lived in a suburb now where the affordability is ridiculous, perhaps not as bad as Sydney. But back then it was probably considered affordable. And so I can remember a lot of my close mates, I'd go home from school, I'd go to their place after school when their parents were home. And so that was most of the time that was true with my mum. She was home, but she would often work nights, either stacking shelves at the supermarket or as a nurse. And my old man used to run a workshop from home. So he'd have a carport. Freestanding carport, and would be fixing people's cars or lawnmowers or chainsaws, you name it. But I didn't feel like it was anything unusual. In fact, I used to love lying on a Hessian bag underneath the car, watching my dad fix stuff, you know, changing bearings or uni joints, or, you know, repairing an exhaust. And back then, you know, the cars, I was small enough, I could sit in the engine bay while Dad was working on it. Yeah. These days, the manufacturers don't leave any room for anything in the engine bay. And, yeah, I can remember my mum used to, she was quite, and she probably doesn't really even know this upon reflection, she was quite enterprising. So she would do little things that would make money to keep the household going, where she would, I can remember going to these factories where you'd get like a box of bottle tops that would go on top of like pump bottles. And so we would bring them home, and you'd do part of the process of completing that, you know, that assembly, I guess, like clamping them down, locking them, and you'd go from one box to the next, and we'd all sit around and do it. And I don't think it was probably years before I realized that was to make money. They as a result, we never went without anything. I'm forever grateful.
I bet. And I'm interested to know, while you're sitting in that engine bay and, you know, clamping the bottle tops on those bottles, did you get a sense of what kind of work was like? And maybe did you start to think at an early age what you wanted to become work-wise?
Yeah, I remember thinking that this is a lot of work. I remember thinking this is not what I want to do. Like I always had a fascination with pulling things apart and putting them back together. In fact, it became somewhat of a in joke in our family, where people would laugh that I'd take the TV out of the and take, you know, we had a little, one of those little TVs in the back room. Yeah. It was missing. It was because it was out the back and I'd taken it apart. And they just had to wait for me to put it back together before we'd be able to watch it again. I had a fascination with pulling things apart and putting them back together. And I knew that I definitely wasn't going to be a nurse because I saw, you know, kind of how my mum was treated and how she felt about the work that she did. And she was a Division II nurse and that not treated so well. They get all the crap jobs. And I saw the work that my dad was doing. I thought, well, it's a lot of hard work. It's lots of manual labor. And I knew perhaps maybe there was somewhere in between. So I went through all sorts of things, you know, and I as technology became more prevalent, became fascinated with it. And I started to think this is probably my spot here. It's a,
how old were you when you were thinking that way?
Probably 9 or 10, I think.
Really? That's quite
young. Yeah. And, you know, my parents, you know, working so hard, they, I can remember, I don't even know if it exists anymore, but I can remember concepts like lay-by and, you know, almost like a hire purchase as well. Those sorts of concepts came around in the 80s. And I can remember my parents doing like a kind of like a hire purchase on a computer.
Right.
And they like it makes me emotional thinking about it now, what that strain, like financial strain, would have been. But they did that for us, and you know, got this computer because they could see that I was interested in it. And you know, like it would have been, you know, I've got a laptop on the table in front of me that cost maybe $1,500. This computer back then that had the computing power of my watch. It was probably $5,000 or $6,000 back then, which is, you know, upon reflection, was probably a third of my mum's annual salary. Yeah, and so I loved the concept of the technology and I was fascinated that this computer could do these things, but then also had a bit of a commitment to make good on that. The fact that my parents had invested in that, I kind of saw this is an opportunity for me to show them that I can turn that into something.
You really felt that at that young age?
Yeah, I can remember one of my friends came over and he was just like, he was blown away that we had a computer.
Yeah.
And I was thinking, wow, you know, from a socioeconomic sort of standpoint, I thought that his family was doing a lot better than us. And so it felt like a real privilege because I was one of those kids that would go to everyone else's house and play with their Commodore 64 or their Atari or whatever, and we never owned those sorts of things.
Yeah.
And then, I think it hit me that this is something that I could have a go at. And, you know, and I would, back then this was pre-Windows. This was, you know, really basic, like a blinking prompt on the screen.
Yeah.
And I would sit there for hours, even just in a word processor. I was quite a creative kid, so I'd actually just even just type stories up just because it was something I could do on the computer.
Yeah. And was your sister also in that vein, that technology vein? And
No,
was it
not
something
really
that you felt like was something that your parents, you know, provided for you to thrive?
I think it was probably more... There's probably a couple of factors there. I probably hogged it. I probably didn't give her a go. And my mum was really interested in it, which I've only just really, that's only really dawned on me just now that she was really interested in it. And I, you know, I love my mum dearly. And it was kind of our thing that we did as well. And my sister was more, she was more academic and she was more into reading and studying, and she probably would have been more inclined to pick up the encyclopedia than to use the computer.
Yeah. Wow. And then obviously at that age, you know, there's a lot of other things kind of happening in life, sport, you know, was that a big area in your life as well?
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Actually, that's something that I look back on right now, actually, is really formative for me, that I played, you name it, I had a go at it, but I loved Aussie rules football. I was a pathetic cricketer, but I loved it. I loved the sport. You know, back in the early 90s, it was the rise of pajama cricket, the day-night cricket and the excitement. Yeah. You know, I loved that. I played basketball as well. I loved basketball. Yeah, I still love it to this day. Actually, it's one of the sports that I watch a lot. I wasn't particularly good at that either. And I think it was, I played netball. You know, I had a shot at everything. And, you know, my sister and I were a little competitive with that. We're actually not competitive people, which kind of might come as a surprise. But she was quite a gifted netballer. She played netball at a really high standard, and we'd go, the weekends were dominated with that. So different time of the year, I'd have little athletics on a Saturday morning. Following the calendar, she would have netball, you know, football on a Sunday. It was a big part of our household as well. You know, we're all avid Essendon Bombers supporters. Okay. So, you know, they were really good through the 80s and early 90s. And so that was a bit of a fixture in our house as well. I can remember crowding around watching the delayed telecast. Imagine that today, if they called it a delayed telecast.
Yeah.
People would be up in arms. Yeah,
that's right.
We'd watch that. And football became a big part of my life. You know, I played from, I think, the age of 7 or 8, up until my mid-20s, and I played at a pretty high level and with a lot of talented footballers, and I learned a lot of things about myself, about teams, about people, about leadership as well. And I think, that when I look back on that these days, there's milestones like 10-year anniversaries, 20-year anniversaries and those sorts of things, and you meet with those people and I think, wow, actually playing football in particular had a huge impact on who I am, you know, as a person and as a professional.
Why do you think that was so?
I think in my professional life, I could confidently say that I've never worked under or with a good leader. And it's a little sad, but in my personal life, there was a couple of coaches that I played under that were great leaders and taught me a lot about what I valued as a leader. And I played football in the suburb that I live in today, actually, a suburb called Oak Park. And it's right it's like a wedge between, like back then, like the haves and the have nots, like an affluent suburb on the other side of the creek and everyone else that, you know, was fighting in the blue collar sort of to make ends meet. And so it became like a bit of a melting pot for exposure. And our coach was from the affluent side of the creek, but he was a working class and he had fought for everything that he created, self-employed, entrepreneur, had a seafood business. So it was early hours, those sorts of things. And he taught me a lot about leadership. And he was often led by doing, by setting the example. And so we had a mixture of kids. Some were jerks. Some were my best mates. And, you know, we had a lot of success. I think when I go back to that club now, which I coach the under eights there at the moment, I look at the photos on the wall and I see, you know, it's like walking down memory lane, you know, for all the way from 1992, I think was first premiership, through to, you know, 2002, I think I played in a premiership as well.
Wow. It's a huge stretch in a sporting career, like from, you know, those early ages to the mid-20s, you said.
Yeah.
What was the experience like towards... I never played in a team sport in my mid-20s. I was more individual sports by then. But early days, I played soccer, football, you know, all those team sports and loved it. What was it like in the mid-20s playing those sports and team sports compared to when you were younger? Big difference?
Yeah, it is. And when I... I look at why I sort of stopped as well. When I was playing in my mid-20s and that sort of end, people are working and either deciding that they're going to get that balance between trying to play amateur football and hold down their job, or committing to playing a higher level of football, or just committing to their job. Mm. And so it's quite funny, I played while committing 100% to my job. So
right.
I very rarely trained. In fact, I felt a little bit of guilt around that because I had enough talent that I'd get picked every week based on the way I played the week before rather than how I trained. And so I copped a fair bit, which was, I probably would have been the one, you know, slinging the comments if I was, you know, shoe was on the other foot.
Yeah.
But I kind of like that, I think. And I would look at people that could make that balance work and think, wow, that's pretty cool. Lots of tradies that would be really have great little self, you know, self-employed sort of small business, but they really valued the sport and they'd have a great business and then they'd come and, you know, train two or three nights a week and then play on the weekend. And I always admired that. And even the players that would turn up late to the game because they were working that morning, you know, because they're trying to keep their business going. You know, I really respected that. And as a kid, there was a window there where when you're really young, it's just about having fun. And you just want to, the score becomes more important as you get older, but it was just about having fun. And there's a window in the middle there around sort of 17 to 20 where it's really serious. Like that's your window. If you're going to make a go of it, that's your window. And then you cross over the threshold sort of mid-20s where you're just doing it for fun again because you're not going to make the pros. And it was kind of good. And I you know, I've had a lot of success. So that galvanizes people as well. And I think if I was to see any of those guys that I played premierships with as an adult anywhere, we'd instantly be able to pick up conversation and reminisce and talk about, you know, some of the perhaps silly things that we did. And yeah.
That's awesome. And in that window between 17 and 20, did you consider turning professional?
Yeah, I did. Yeah. What was that like? It was probably one of the biggest lessons in my life. You know, age 16, I played school football as well as local football. And I'm 6'3 now and 110 kilos. And, you know, back then I was a bit of a whippet. You know, I wasn't a tall kid and I was pretty wiry. And I grew through high school. I grew pretty quickly. And I went to a really rough high school that produced quite a few good footballers. And so they knew, a lot of the scouts and things knew in the back of their mind that there might be some talent in this area. And so they kept a casual eye on it. Anyway, so probably 16 or 17, year 11 at high school, I was sort of tapped on the shoulder and said, we'd like you to get on our list at one of the elite under 18 teams. And in what was called the TAC Cup back then. And so, yeah, I thought, you know what? I've worked pretty hard to this point. People are telling me I should play, that I should be a footballer. I was strong, I was fit. And I thought, yeah, okay, let's do this. And so, so I trained, you know, with my local team and with that team. And it was probably four or five nights a week. And you'd play either Friday night, Saturday or Sunday as a bit of a moving fixture. And I started to, because I was training so much, I started to get really fit. And I thought, you know what, I'm actually not the most gifted footballer, but I can get the ball. And I was pretty fit. And so I got really applied myself. And then it came to a crunch time where it, I can remember, and it gives me a bit of a shiver thinking about it. I was sitting in the change rooms at this elite club just before they were about to go into the process of prepping people to go into the AFL. And they do all sorts of things like media training and all that. And I sat there and I looked around the room and I thought, you know what? This isn't my place. I actually don't like any of these people here. They're here for a different reason to me. It was cutthroat. They'd throw you under the bus in a second if it meant they got a spot ahead of you. This isn't a team sport. This is just a heap of individuals that have been put in a room and told whoever's the fastest, the strongest, can jump the highest, we'll get a go. Right. And I thought that love of the team sport, all those things that I enjoyed, none of that was present. And I'd had a pretty bad back injury as a teenager. I had a stress fracture in my lower back. And the way they treated me through that process was pretty substandard as well. And so my parents were wearing a lot of the costs of MRIs and scans and stuff. And then, I can remember my old man dropping me off at training, and I thought, you know what, this is my last training session. And so I walked up into the footy manager's office, which is this pokey little office in Coburg. And I just said to him, and I can remember the look on his face. I said to him, I'm quitting. I can't keep showing up here, and I can't keep dealing with my back injury. And it's just, yeah. And he just said, okay, off you go.
Right.
Yeah. And so I knew then that it was the right choice. And I was probably picking up on all that energy, that bad energy. And I went back to my local club and I picked up sort of halfway through the season and came runner up in the best and fairest. Cause I went back with a, belly fire and loved the sport again. Yeah.
Mm. And looking back on that experience now, do you feel like that window, as you call it, it was almost like a window of fire where, people would have to cross the chasm and then it would be more team orientated? Or do you feel like, no, that's entry point into professional life. You need to be okay with it. Otherwise it's not for you, period.
Yeah, I think the latter. I'm optimistic that that's changed now. But back then, I think it was a kind of kill or be killed sort of thing. And that's just how it is. And that actually had nothing to do with the players. That was how they were managed. That's how they were coached. And yeah, I look at it now. Like I love the game. I could watch the two bottom teams play quite happily. I don't watch it for the result. I watch it for the love of the sport. And I watch them now, and I see, albeit that they copped a little bit of criticism recently, but the Western Bulldogs are in through to the grand final, and there was footage of them handing out beers after the game, and it was kind of frowned upon. And I just thought, wow, it's frowned upon by people who don't know, who don't understand what they've been through together. And they just think, oh, these guys get paid, $1 million. I think that's not enough. and that camaraderie looks like it's there. And I think maybe it comes after a while, but it definitely wasn't prevalent in that window when I was there.
Obviously, around that time, there's other elements to life and social scenes picking up, girls and what have you. Also, I would say the formation of a career would be probably competing for your time. Were you in the workplace in around that window period as well? And what were you doing?
Yeah, so I've worked my whole life. So I was a paper boy from the age of 10 and had a couple of paper rounds because I wanted to earn more money, even though I never spent a cent. But anyway, yeah, I've worked my whole life, and my school wasn't, I chose my school, which is funny. Like I look back on it, I went to a really rough school, but I could have gone to any school that I wanted, but I've never been academic. And so I never prioritized that. So my school was really supportive of the sport pursuit because they weren't chasing the highest, enter scores or whatever they're called now. They were just wanting the kids to survive and to have a go, have a go at whatever they were passionate about. But I definitely worked. I had lots of, I worked at a, Target store from the age of 14. And I was probably working there while I was playing football and going to school as well. So my parents, the sacrifices they made to ferry us to every sport training several nights a week.
Busy household.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, footy kit. I probably bought my own stuff, boots and jumpers and stuff, because I had earned money my whole life. I worked at, yeah, I've had lots of, you know, sort of jobs along the way, but I always remember working and prioritizing the fact that I had to work. And I think that was ingrained in me watching my parents, and it never felt like, and I never felt like I was being pushed into doing anything. And you know, being a paper boy at the age of 10, didn't even feel unusual either. Like, my son is nearly 8 now, and I think, wow, I don't know how he'd go at 10 being a paper boy. But yeah, and that, and you sort of mix all that in. I was one of those kids that underachieved at school. Like, I was always smart enough, but I was one of those kids that sat there in like maths and thought, I'm never going to need to know all this sort of stuff about angles and probability and all this sort of stuff. And I can add, I can subtract, you know, I can multiply. so it meant that I didn't apply myself. And I was always a kid that would ask questions as well. And I think the type of school that I went to, the teachers probably weren't equipped with the answers. So that just kept falling lower and lower on the priorities. And, you know, I probably had a girlfriend too young as well. Had, you know, probably age 15, 16. I say too young because I've got a daughter as well, and I'd hope that she has her first boyfriend in her mid-20s.
Yeah, it takes note of this.
Yeah. Yeah, and so I think I probably gave too much attention to the social side of it as well.
Mm.
And it was a bit of a rolling stone as far as, you know, social circles went. I didn't have like my clique, that like my crew that I just hung out with, because, you know, I could walk one way down my street and hang out with, you know, generations of Lebanese kids that I love dearly. And I'd go turn right out the driveway and I'd hang out with, you know, some Aussie kids that are fifth generation, and then everything in between. And I love that. And I think through high school, there was quite a large Polynesian community moved into the area as well. And I just, so much love for Polynesian people, beautiful culture, beautiful people. And so I would just sort of float between these groups and could talk to anyone and could hang out with anyone that I chose, which was handy at parties, because no matter where you went, like, I'd have someone that I knew.
Sounds like school was the absolute perfect environment for you, apart from the schoolwork part.
Yeah, it was absolutely spot on. I couldn't have said it better myself.
Do you feel like when with that schoolwork, do you feel like, you know, you could see that, hey, I'm not going to need that. That presumes that you probably at that age, maybe either consciously or subconsciously knew what you were going to do. Did you?
I think it was subconscious. If I look back, you know, they used to give you the planner of your, where you've got your first two periods, second, last two. If I looked at that and I saw something like, PE or IT, even actually I kind of liked social studies, like learning about history and stuff like that. Those sorts of topics, and I'd love it. And then hopefully my mum doesn't listen to this. You know, she probably will. She's a great supporter of mine. If I saw stuff that I didn't want, I would just go somewhere. I'd find something else to do. And it kind of is a little bit what I'm like now. and it just didn't, it was definitely subconscious around the way I approached it. But I also didn't feel like a lot of the things that we learned really were important to me as a person. I loved art as well, like anything to do with art. And it was a technical school that I went to as well. So right up until year 11 and 12, we had like sheet metal shop, we had woodwork, we had automotive, all those sorts of things. But they stopped at VCE because that's not what the government prescribed. But in year 11, I'd heard about this thing, pre-apprenticeships for VCE students. And so there was a pre-apprenticeship in technology. I thought, wow, that's cool. I like the fact that it says apprenticeship in it as well, because it means I don't have to go to uni. So I started that in year 11 and year 12. I already was underway to basically getting a diploma in network engineering, which doesn't exist anymore, which is a crying shame. But straight out of high school, I went into what's now called a traineeship. And in IT, and when I look back, I went straight into local government as well. Right. And that was probably the best and the worst thing that could have happened, because local government lives up to its reputation of, you know, their work ethic. And then it kind of facilitated a bit of laziness, you know, just finished year 12, graduated by the skin of my teeth, and then went into an environment where work was just almost optional. But I was still learning, and that was the thing that probably interested me, and that was in a technology stream. And I've got lots of trade certificates that aren't worth anything now, not even recognized, because this was at the year 2000 where they decided that IT was a graduate. You needed to have a bachelor's degree to have a recognized qualification in IT. So almost as they were printing these diplomas and certificates that I'd earned, they weren't worth anything. But it didn't matter, because I'd gone straight literally into the workforce the year that I finished year 12. December of that year, I was straight in, yeah.
Right. And what was the next chapter after the local government?
Well, when I was there, I was bored and frustrated. I had a real hard ass as a boss, but he taught me heaps. You know, he was very hands-on, and his attitude was, if you're going to do this, you need to actually know how to do it. You know, I don't want you to just have the theory. I want you to have actually done it. And he allowed [S2] Right. [S1] Me to build labs, and I was doing stuff that, you know, was probably 10 years ahead of, you know, what was back then sort of earned opportunity. And he was, he's still there, actually. I dropped in a few years ago just to see [S2] Wow. [S1] If he was there, and he's still there. His name was Chris, he's still there. And he gave me a lot of opportunity, but I was just bored. The pace was just really slow. So I bounced around for a couple of years after that. I worked at Compaq when they were a company, and they were bought by HP. So I got to experience that corporate takeover, which is kind of funny for a 20-year-old or, you know, 19-year-old. went through the experience of losing your job on a Friday and then being rehired as a contractor on the Monday with a pay rise. You know, when HP bought Compaq.
Yes.
It's kind of funny. Quite funny. My two jobs after that were pay cuts, because I was just bored. I wanted to do something different, but I stayed committed to technology, and I worked in a law firm as their IT, in-house IT person. I learned a lot there, that how poorly treated paralegals are and how poorly treated article clerks are, and the corner office syndrome. I learned all about that at sort of the age of 20. And they promoted me pretty quickly to an IT management position, because they could see that I had the talent. And I think they probably thought, for 30 grand a year, if we can pay an IT manager 30 grand a year, then we're on a winner here.
Yeah.
So I probably squeezed a couple of grand more out of them over the journey. But then I started to hear about these IT companies, like service providers, where they provide IT, but to companies, you know, lots of companies. I thought, wow, that sounds like a lot more fun. Right. And so I started looking for jobs, and I found it's probably Seek. I don't know, Seek that old? Probably.
Yeah, probably. Yeah.
Yeah, found a job, went to this interview, was in a bit of a back blocks of Richmond in an office above a printing press and met this guy. And I just remember thinking, wow, this looks like it's just been stood up. overnight. But you know what? I've got nothing to lose. So I took the job there. And my mum tells a story that when I came home, I was living out of home, but when I used to go home for dinner, I went home and she tells a story now that she thought, I've taken this job, I'm going to go there tomorrow and they're not going to be there. Yeah, so that was powering it. And it was two guys in this office. And, funny story, broke my ankle the weekend before I started. I was playing footy, broke my ankle, and I was in hospital. And they said, oh, we're going to take you off to put in a cast. And I'm like, you can't put in a cast. I was starting a new job on Monday. And they're like, no, if you don't put a cast on you, your recovery is going to go from 3 months to who knows. I said, you're not putting a cast on. So, wow. So they put one of those moon boots on and I was off. I was at, you know, at PowerNet. And that was a major point in my life. I was 21. And at that point, I thought, this is where it's at, you know, providing a service to people, multiple people, helping lots of people and learning more every day than I probably learned in the 20 years prior.
Was that the key reason why you felt like it was exciting? Was because you weren't just working with the same people with one business. You were now going to be meeting a whole lot more people with a whole lot more different kind of work issues and challenges and IT challenges. Most appealing?
Yeah, spot on. And also just dropping into these businesses. Like, I loved it. I would talk to the business owner and learn. And that learning was just compounded week after week and got to a point where I can vividly remember thinking, I'm working too hard for someone else. And this is, I can't keep doing this. I'm earning next to nothing and having the time of my life, but earning next to nothing. And if I'm going to put all this work in, I should be, you know. And yeah, my mates would say to me, oh, you want to start your own business. But I was fiercely loyal. And I got to a point where I sat down with the owner of that business and just said to him, I don't want to leave. I love working here. I love what we do. But if you don't give me an opportunity to become an owner in this business, I'm going to have to leave and we'll be competitors. And
how old were you then?
Probably, good question, probably late 20s, maybe. I'd work there.
Yeah.
Yeah. Probably for maybe five years or so before I had this conversation. So,
right.
Yeah, mid-20s, I'd say, yeah.
Did it take a lot for you to have that conversation? Was that a build up of a long time, or was it waking up one day and said, now's the time?
No, it was definitely a build up because I was building the team in the business. So, tapping into all that football experience, I was building a team around me. And the owner of the business was the classical e-myth. He was the technician. I was the entrepreneur and the manager. And he was really technician. He was a technician to the point where he would do more hours in a day than humanly possible.
Yeah.
But just on the tools. And so I built this business with help, like lots of good people around me. And then it just built up to a point where I thought, this isn't the future for me. I need more control over my future. And to his credit, he gave me lots of opportunities. I kept every opportunity. I kept buying more of the business, buying into the business. And he gave me that opportunity lots of times. And it was, when I look back on it, he should have, because I would do the same in his position if I had an employee that was doing this. And that really gave me that, formalized the fact that I was a business owner, because I'd always had that mindset. And the business, we took it from nothing to, three or four people to, close to 100 people over the, the nearly 17 years that I was there.
Well, I'm interested to dig into that growth story. But before I do, did you have a backup plan if he said, sorry, Dan, I love you, but that's not going to happen? Did you have a backup plan?
Yeah, I was going to do it. I was going to go it on my own. Yeah.
right?
Yeah.
And look, and then now looking at what you obviously had a tremendous growth in that business. What if you took that other path? How do you think that would have played out? Do you ever think about that?
No, not really. You know, and it's unusual for me to have a plan B, if I'm honest. I'm a it's plan A and it's going to work.
Yeah.
Sort of guy.
Well, maybe if I could ask you to just pause on that thought and just run us through that 3 to 4 people to 100 people, that growth story.
Yeah.
And then we'll come back to that. So what was it like growing? Because that's a phenomenal growth story.
Yeah. So it was a matter of me realizing early that if we were going to grow and we were going to need people or talent around us, and I was the only one who really prioritized that, which is why now reflecting on it, I was the entrepreneur in that business, not the one who started it and not the one who was doing all the technical delivery, but the one who was thinking about where we were going and why. And I would literally just find good people and interview all the time and be hiring, fostering relationships with clients. I was selling without knowing that I was selling, building capability, forging relationships with vendors and suppliers. And I was just like switching left foot, right foot, doing all these things. And I was exhausted. And I can remember one of the people in the team, saying to me, Dan, you've stacked a bit of weight on. And I'm like, you know what? I have. So something's got to change. And so I started to then become more conscious of how I was leading as well. And I think when I crossed that threshold of actually wanting to be a leader that people wanted to follow, and that meant not just doing the work, but actually not worrying, but thinking and being more conscious about how I looked as well as a leader. If I led an unhealthy lifestyle, unhealthy balance, then I was promoting that with the team. And so then what that's started to, I started to notice is that once I started taking care of that, and leading, setting a positive example, people wanted to work for us and wanted to be a part of it. And so we would grow. We got to a point where, you know, we would be able to sell computers, like no problem. Everyone needed them. You didn't need to sell them because everyone needed them. It was about whether you could, you know, click your fingers and you could deliver them and provide a good service. And so we went through that sort of classic, fill the room with people who can set up computers and drop them. And then you start to get the odd complaint or you get, you know, things returned. And then actually we need someone who can talk to the customers, because if we're talking to the customers, we're not delivering. And so I would just naturally think, you know, what do we need next? And then the invoicing became sloppy or late. Actually, we need someone doing that. Or the market's a lot more competitive now. We need someone who can go out and sell. And so just literally organically building, you know, to a point where we had a lot of success in attracting customers and retaining them and retaining people. And the entrepreneurial lessons were coming thick and fast. And, you know, there's a person in our life that has, you know, brought us together, you and I. I'll give him a shout out, Daniel Davis. I met him over 10 years ago and he introduced my business partner and I to the concept of having a structure in a business. And he worked with us, to his credit, against the odds, and helped us sort of introduce some structure. And I remember thinking, why didn't I have this at the start? Because this would have been a lot easier. All the mistakes that I've made, people challenges, those sorts of things. And then, you know, that evolved into EOS and the entrepreneurial operating system. And when we learned, when we implemented that in the business, we just looked back and it was like not even night and day. It was like Earth and Pluto. Yeah. It was completely different planets at opposite ends of the solar system. And you know, I look back and just think, you know, so many times where I had really tough conversations with people because, and in the essence, they didn't align with our values, but we didn't have values. We didn't, they weren't, didn't have names, or people weren't performing, and you just had to, you knew they weren't performing, but you didn't have KPIs or a scorecard and all those sort of little things that I would reflect upon. And then when we implemented this system, this operating system, it was like, there was a block of timber behind the accelerator.
Yep.
And it was stopping us pushing the pedal. And then when we put this structure in, it was like removing that block. Suddenly we could push that pedal to the floor. And the growth from that point went from, we're talking maybe over the space of 5 years, from maybe 8 or 9 million to in excess of 20 million in that time.
That's pretty incredible growth. I'm interested to know, you know, removing that block of timber, you know, can you pinpoint kind of the main things that changed that really led to that explosive growth?
Well, from a pardon me, from a personal perspective, I was in the integrator seat.
Okay.
And you know me now, and I'm not an integrator's asshole. So,
and by integrator we mean like a general management.
Yeah, position. The person in the middle keeps all the
running the day to day.
Yeah, exactly. Keeps the trains running on time. Keeps everyone connected and accountable. So that epiphany that's not me, and I was I was the zebra coloring in the gap between the stripes every day, coming in as a black horse. And we elevated Alana. She's one of my most favorite people on the planet, and elevated her into that seat and got me out of it. And that in itself was like, we greased the wheels. Things are starting to move. And she's far more disciplined and focused than what I am. And then it freed me up to be the entrepreneur in the business, the visionary that could be deliberate about what we're doing next. And even galvanizing people behind core values, you know, a big part of EOS is, you know, you start with that. And that those two things alone, and that ripple effect of then having an attentive person in the middle in that integrator seat, attentive to the needs of the heads of department and all that sort of stuff. My business partner, Jacob, giving him the freedom that he didn't need to be a leader as well. You know, he could, the freedom to own his unique abilities of, you know, being out there in front of the customer, selling the dream. It was like all these ripples across the pond, you know, that allowed us to all play to our unique strengths. And it's like, and that's what I love, you know, the privilege now today of being able to help businesses experience that. And I can remember probably 6 months in to that process with Daniel, and I said to him, I'm going to do this. Wow. I want to be an EOS implementer. And he said, you know, just keep your feet on the ground. We've just started. And he said to me, he was still learning as well.
Yeah.
And I reckon every 6 months I went back to him and said, I'm going to do this, you know, to the point where the business was so strong and so stable, had elevated people and elevated me to the point where I sat down with my business partners. I'd accumulated business partners at that stage through mergers and acquisitions. And I sat down with them, and I can remember this being a really gut-wrenching conversation, where I sat down with them and said, I want to be an EOS implementer. I want to stay here in the business as well. And I believe that I can do both. And before you tell me that I can't, let me show you. And I did, you know, for 2 years, I was the CEO of that company and a part-time EOS, professional EOS implementer. And it was like, I'd often describe it as two cups, the fire and the unique situation of being CEO of one of Australia's best IT service providers, dropping into businesses, playing to my unique ability, and then going out and helping other businesses and business owners elevate themselves to that same experience. It was like it was a perfect balance until it wasn't. it was a really unique time. And but then I ended up in that position where I wasn't balancing things well. But yeah, that
was that because it was having a it was too hard for you personally to manage, or was there business repercussions that the business needed more love in that seat?
I think a bit of both of those, and a young family as well. You know, right. Having a young family and balancing 3-4 loves. You know, my marriage, my love of my kids, the love of the PowerNet business and my EOS business. I felt like I was trying to be everything to everyone, and in the IT business, had business partners that I had an obligation to, both legally, financially, all those sorts of things. And I didn't feel like I still loved that business the way that I did once upon a time. And I think it was because I was experiencing a connection with my purpose. You know, if my purpose is to, you know, connect people with their own possibilities. And I was too far removed as a CEO of that business to really do that anymore. And I had a moment in my life that pulled the handbrake massively on everything and forced me to reflect. And, you know, October 2019, I walked away from that business and didn't come back. And then, you know, last year I sold, 2020, I sold the remaining shares that I had in the business and, you know, burnt that boat, as we say. Yeah. And now wake up every morning with this overwhelming sense of purpose and gratitude. And the gratitude extends to that that first opportunity as well, back where I sat there and said, you know, give me an opportunity to become a business owner or effectively going to become competitors. And everything in between, the heartache of having to, you know, let people go who I've become close with on the journey, you know, dealing with data loss in IT terms, you know, dealing with the risk of losing it all, gratitude for every, you know, sleeping on a server room floor, you know, because a customer needed something, all of that in between. I have its gratitude now, and I bounce out of bed. There's not a day that goes by where I think I just don't want to get up today. And, you know, all along the way, all these accumulated touch points of experience, I now get to show up and give those to my clients every day. And I wish I had someone like me or you back then in the beginning, because you know that would have changed. So if I was open, if I was, you know, as we say, you know, frustrated, stuck, open-minded, respectful, all those sorts of things, then, which I think I was, I would have changed everything. Yeah. And that's the privilege that we have now, to be able to give that to other people.
It is. I can wholeheartedly agree. I'm going to unpause that question from that fork in the road moment with the plan B that, you know, you may or may not have had, but I kind of like, want to bring you back there, but I feel like almost it's a bit redundant now, yeah. Because now knowing where your journey has gone to, it's almost like I'm happy for you to kind of give me your thoughts, but
yeah,
you had to take this journey to find where you are right now, because you seem so fulfilled with what you're doing.
Yeah, it was all predetermined. There was no plan B. I told myself there was, but there was no plan B.
Yeah.
It was all predetermined. I just needed to show up and give it everything and, you know, keep being that leader that I wish I had. And that's, you know, that has fueled me. And right now I'm exactly where I was meant to be. And I love that. I'm at peace with that. And it doesn't mean I'll wake up and think, you know, I'm just going to meander, just let it unfold today because it's predetermined.
Yeah.
I still need to show up and give it everything. But I honestly believe that, just like you and I sitting here right now, this is all predetermined as well.
Mm. Got it. And for those of our listeners who don't know what EOS is or what an EOS implementer is, can you tee that up for us and give us some context?
Yeah. So So EOS, the entrepreneurial operating system, is effectively, I could give you the postcard version of it, or I'll just give you Dan Williams' version.
Give us Dan Williams' version.
Okay, so it's a set of tools that actually allow you to get more done in your business and for the right reasons. So it's tools, principles, processes, all those sorts of things that most business owners either don't know that they exist, or they think it's too hard, or it's just going to take more time than what they already don't have. So it's a set of tools, systems, processes that actually allows you to align towards the true North Star that is yours and for your business, and then allows you to achieve that without actually having sat through any formal training or education, because it's all practical. You start from day one, which suits the Dan Williams that went to a technical school. We're right into it from day one, and it starts working from day one. And we follow this process, using tools that have been proven over and over and over, and all in packaged up in a way that is simple, and it gets the results. And, you know, as long as we don't mess with the formula, cleaned it up for you. As long as we don't mess with the formula, it works, and it will continue to work forever. And, you know, an EOS implementer, where the practitioners that have the privilege of taking businesses through that process, and being able to, you know, be the wingman, wingwoman to these business owners and leadership teams. You know, keep them accountable as well. It's not all cupcakes and rainbows. Sometimes we need to give them a foot in the ass. And other times we just high five each other, you know, maybe with elbows or fist bump these days. And it's the greatest, nearly swore again. It's the greatest privilege that you could ever imagine to be able to be a part of that and to see the business owners experience that true control of their business.
That's well put. And by the way, this is Entrepreneurs Uncut. So
yeah, okay.
However it comes out, it comes
all
out.
Right, okay.
if you were to rewind back to that classroom where the angles and the probabilities and the math and the geography wasn't going to be relevant, what if these tools and concepts were somehow taught? Do you think at that young age you would have been receptive, or did you need to live a work life and a business journey to be able to appreciate it?
I don't think it would have meant anything to me back then.
Yeah.
I don't think I was open to receive. It's a maturity. It's an ignorance, ignorance. And probably a bit of arrogance as well, like teenage arrogance, yeah. You know, you can't tell me. I needed to walk my own path and to go through that, the highs, the lows, and to know what I didn't know. For it to truly have an impact. And I see that now, some companies that I meet, and we go through the first step is the 90-minute meeting to introduce business owners and their leadership teams to this. And I can tell, like, pretty early in that process whether they're actually open to receive this or not. And it breaks my heart sometimes, because I look at some people and think, you really need this, but it's the wrong time. You're not ready. It's not a no, it's just a not now. And, you know, I think if they taught it in schools, most of it would just go over people's heads. I think back then, my priorities were different, you know, sports and cars and girls. But I'd say for most people, it would be similar. And I'd say even early on in my entrepreneurial journey, I probably wasn't ready either.
I completely agree. And it's almost like a loaded question I asked, because I wasn't so much interested in the Dan Williams back in the teenager in the classroom, if he was interested. But that question got me thinking about business owners and entrepreneurs who start businesses. They don't really appreciate these things until they've experienced some pain. Mm-hmm. And they've experienced that frustration of what it's like to grow, what it's like to have to make money, build teams, work with people. These things, they're very hard to learn in a classroom, because it needs to be practical. And you need to have an appreciation of it. And typically appreciation is built from hey, I'm sick of having to put up with this anymore and there must be a better way. And if you haven't experienced it yet, it's very hard to appreciate it. And finding the right time is that humility to realize, hey, I'm open to understanding if this can help me, and, you know, and deliver from a practical sense.
Yeah, and I think context is key. Without context, then people never really connect with the subject matter. Or, you know, if I don't know why I need to know this, and I can't feel that, then I know personally, even today, without context, I struggle to grapple with ideas and things people try and teach me if I don't understand why I need to know it. So you're spot on.
And fast forward to today, what does your practice look like now?
So today, EOS is a big part of my life. So I'm working with 23 different companies at the moment, and majority of those are technical, technology oriented IT businesses, which are my people, and I love them. That's waking up every day on purpose doing that work. But I recently started a company called Independent Executives as well, which is helping with that integrator seat that we talked about earlier, that person in the middle. Helping provide that on a part-time, fractional, sort of as a service basis,
How did the need arise for that business?
So a lot of conversations that I have with other EOS implementers and clients is that that seat, integrator seat, the person in the middle, is the hardest to fill. It's the hardest to get right because it's generally these entrepreneurial businesses, they're spinning many plates, these individuals. And if they just had access to an expert that could help them fill that talent gap, then they would be far more successful. They would be able to focus on their own unique abilities. And instead of chasing unicorns, trying to find that perfect integrator, if they were able to work with what they had and had external support, they'd be successful. And so that concept came to me 3 years ago, and I chipped away at it to the point where Sammy and Murray, my business partners in that, agreed that this was a real thing, and we united and launched that business. We're officially launching it in November of 2021, but we have done a soft launch. So I'm excited. And that's that waking up every day on purpose, that entrepreneurial fire, spending majority of my time in the session room. It fuels all of these other things around, which is great, and it's a privilege. Yeah,
that's great. And obviously from one of your previous businesses, PowerNet, through that growth trajectory that you had and that realization, you had that epiphany of you needed an integrator because you realized that it wasn't necessarily your kind of highest best use for your time and your value input into the business. And was that Alana that stepped up? Was that?
Yeah.
So it's almost like for companies that don't have an Alana, what do they do?
Yeah.
And maybe they're not in the position to maybe hire a full-time integrator or all the risks associated with that. Maybe they need someone that's a bit more proven.
Yeah.
Is that the need that it fills?
Yeah, spot on. And sometimes it's an affordability as well.
Yeah.
People tell themselves that they can't afford to hire a general manager or a COO or whatever. The title's kind of irrelevant. It's the function. It's that person in the middle. And if they could, for a fraction of the cost, have access to someone who has all of those skills that will allow them to maintain the EOS, the entrepreneurial operating system, in their business. If we make that available, we're solving a real problem that they talked about the ripples in the pond earlier. The ripple effect of nailing that is huge. You know, that what I experienced stepping out of that seat, faking it, I was effectively, a fraud integrator. I was no good at it. that set me free. And I want that. I want that for other people. I want that for as many people as possible.
I've got to say, I think you've been a bit hard on yourself, mate, because that growth trajectory wouldn't have happened, for nothing. So I think there's I think we're all on that spectrum, right? It sounds like you're more visionary than integrator, but I've got to kind of in the bat for you, mate, with that record. It couldn't be that bad.
Thank you. I attribute that to having the right people around me.
Which is it's a key part, certainly. And also what I'm saying is there's this entrepreneurial streak in you. You know, you love helping people, obviously, with your EOS practice. I share the same purpose in my work and I love it. I don't know if you're anything like me, you've still got that entrepreneurial fire. I guess otherwise you wouldn't be trying to create, you know, a business that could solve another need. Is that right?
Yeah. You know, I have two integrators that I work with. So Sammy is the integrator in my independent EQ business, and Murray is the integrator in independent executives business. And because I still have those 20 ideas before breakfast, and as we say in EOS, and I need people to tell me that 19 of them are crap, or that all of them are, because in my other life, I have a visionary business partner. It's the two of us. We've got a couple of businesses, Next Fulfillment and Next Commerce, and we are running on entrepreneurial fire. This is, you know, high octane stuff, and we're having a lot of wins, and we're both really passionate people. But we effectively built a third party logistics business from nothing. Rob has done majority of the work, the heavy lifting there, from nothing at the start of this year to a thriving business at this point, you know, 8 months, 9 months now into the year. Right. And we stood up an e-commerce advisory in the middle of the year to support us. I'll give you the really quick version of why we did it. But we realized that a lot of small online e-commerce brands were being squeezed out of the market by companies like Australia Post and Star Trek and DHL because they didn't have the same throughput as like the Catch of the Day or Kogan or Kmart even these days.
Right.
We wanted to create a solution for those businesses. And so that's where that third-party logistics came in. And now we work with e-commerce brands who don't have, you know, we're giving them the buying power of those big companies and a boutique service that is, that is really personal. And the e-commerce is an extension of that to help them stay in market, stay competitive. And so that's two visionaries in that business. And I'm almost sometimes the integrator in that relationship because Rob, which means, and I know it's like a pattern, you know, I know our next hire is going to be an integrator. And that's exciting to know that now at the start is a beautiful thing. Yeah,
it is. And from an outsider looking in and having familiar with the tools that you know, we work with, what I've seen over the last handful of years is, you know, a really talented guy that probably wasn't in the right seat but could keep things going. But once you've found your right seat, look at all these things that have blossomed, all these new businesses. And that's the power of working with that system and understanding what you love and what you're great at and being willing to kind of let go of some of the things that you maybe not be so great at. And there's other people that really love that stuff and probably could do a better job than us. And it actually makes for better day-to-day work, better businesses, better economies, better life. All because of, I guess, you know, being humble enough to say, hey, this integrator, see this general manager, it's probably not for me. And it's almost taking that step to the side allows other people to really realize their passions, but then the world to benefit with all these new entities being created. Yeah. Do you see that?
Yeah. When you trot it out like that, I do. Yeah. And, you know, I said this to you recently and I feel like I've forged this concept of a portfolio career. And if you're doing that on purpose and in the right seat in all of these companies, as long as you're not sacrificing that balance of family and, you know, self, I think that is the way to supercharge our economy and to supercharge, you know, this new wave of business owner and business operator as well. Like, I think showing up every day and knowing that you are doing what you were meant to be doing, either as the visionary or the integrator or whatever the function, and genuinely wanting to be there and loving it, there's no greater fulfillment in life than that. And if you can get that right for as many people as possible, then everything else will take care of itself.
Well said, mate. I 100% agree. I've enjoyed the chat. I think we ran back the clock, and it's been a great tale. And I feel like, you know, I've almost kind of lived the ups and downs, and in a lot of ways it kind of like parallels my journey. So I feel like we've got a lot in common.
Thank you.
I think it's time maybe to get into our final five questions. You ready to go?
Yeah, let's do it.
All right, mate. So I'm gonna hit you with the first one. Dan, who was your idol growing up?
So, you know what, this is going to sound a little bit arrogant, but I didn't idolize anyone growing up. I had the privilege, you know, of being surrounded by lots of positive influences. My parents, my mom and my dad, you know, cuts a big figure. He's a big dude, intimidating, but very intelligent. My mum, loving, caring. My grandmother, eldest of 13, most resilient woman you'll ever meet. I think I idolized what they represented in my life.
Beautiful, man. How do you think your industry will be different 10 years from now? And I'm interested to maybe take it either or, obviously what you do with EOS, or even with the IT industry, because that's a lot of what your background is, or both.
Yeah, I can quickly touch on both. So I think from EOS perspective, EOS is just the vessel, like the system and tools, everything is just the vessel. If I just look at it, if we extract one more layer from that, I think people, entrepreneurs, are starting to look at coaches differently, and I think that will continue. There has been, people are more educated now about the possibilities, and entrepreneurial energy is supercharged right now. People spending a lot of time pondering possibilities, forced to have that time to ponder possibilities. And I think we will play a different role as coaches, is to help them do it well. I think we'll be working less with 30-year-old businesses that are just looking to tidy things up around the edges and get a bit more control. I think we'll be working with earlier stage businesses to help them set themselves up for success. I think that's a shift that we'll see. And in the IT industry, we say in EOS, you know, to systemize the predictable so we can humanize the exceptional. That's the IT industry in a phrase. They need to their ability to systemize all those predictable things so that they can humanize the exceptional things like service, like personal connection, business understanding. Those that do that will thrive. Those that don't will be bought by those that are thriving.
Very wise. What didn't you know about running a business at the start of your journey that you wished you had known?
I think I grossly underestimated how important it was to have the right people around you, not just people that can do the thing, but people that are the right people, you know, that have, that share those values, you know, that's, and that people would become the biggest asset. It took me too long to recognize that. But I think if I had known that a little earlier, I would have prioritized who I had around me differently. And probably just one other thing is that I used to say the word lucky too much. Oh, just lucky. But luck has nothing to do with it. And if you rely on luck, then someone luckier is going to come along and put you out of business. So, yeah, I think a combination of people and luck, yeah, perspective on both.
That's great. And if you could have earned more money and had more time working for someone else as an employee, would you still run your own business?
I think I'm pretty unemployable. To be honest, this isn't a good resume. I think I was born to do what I do now, but I needed to work for someone else first. If I could go back, you know, money is never a motivator. Like, it's never ever been about the dollars, so it's kind of irrelevant to me. Yeah. Don't know if that's an answer, but you can have it.
No, it is. It is. It's the truth. It's very good. And what does success mean in business to you? Or success in business mean to you, I should say?
Success in business is all about making a positive impact that is bigger than yourself. And if you do that well and you wake up feeling like you're on purpose, that you're doing what you were meant to be doing, and you're helping others and making an impact bigger than yourself, then to me, that is success in business.
I like it, mate. I like it. And I can relate wholeheartedly. It's interesting in our chat, you know, going right from the very beginning, you know, that kid that who was curious, pulling things apart in the classroom, who, you know, a lot of things went over their head and, you know, was only interested in the things that they knew mattered to them, through your footballing career, and you had to make that decision between professional, amateur, and then your work career and taking that leap in the business. One thing, a common thing that I've seen is you're a very intuitive person and you've always backed yourself on that intuition and knowing that you're going to make the right decisions just on that. And I think that it's no surprise that you've led a really colorful life, a life full of achievement, and that a lot of people that have been with you on the journey, obviously your family, but I can speak as a part of someone in your life in the EOS community and the people that you work with now and have worked with in the past, they love you for it. They love you for it. So I just want to acknowledge you for your integrity and living the life on your terms and just being of service. And I've really enjoyed and I've loved, I should say, hearing your story today, mate. So thank you.
Yeah, thank you. I really appreciate the opportunity and appreciate the kind words. Thank you so much.
You're welcome, mate.